Shrink Wrap Radio number 863, Jungian analyst Michael Gellert, LCSW, on his new book, Legacy of Darkness and Light.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest today is Jungian analyst Michael Gellert, LCSW, and we're going to be discussing his most recent book, Legacy of Darkness and Light, Our Cultural Icons and Their God Complex. Now, here's the interview. Jungian analyst Michael Gellert, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much. It's become a bit of a tradition.
Yeah. We should make it a regular thing. It feels like we're making it a pretty regular regular thing. You keep turning out the books, and we'll keep doing these interviews. And so we are going to be talking about your latest book, Legacy of Darkness and Light, Our Cultural Icons and Their God Complex. And before we get into the details of the book, I just wanted to touch on your background a bit more, the bio that you sent me that not everybody's going to have a chance to see. And you have such fascinating origins. You wrote that you come from a line of Hungarian Jews who you grew up in Canada and in Montreal, I think it was, right? And a real cultural hub. And your parents had fled from the Holocaust. So were you already born when they fled or not?
No, I was born, excuse me. I was born 4 years after they finally left Europe and settled in Canada.
Okay. I'm sure there are a lot of family stories about that, but we don't have time to go into that here today. So you said you had a rabbinical education. Does that mean, how was it a rabbinical education? What does that mean?
The word rabbinic there is practically synonymous with Talmudic. So up until, I think, around age 11, my Jewish studies consisted of mostly the biblical stories and liturgy, ritual, and the holidays, and prayer. At 11, my mother got it into her mind to hire the services of a rabbi, and he decided to teach Talmud, which I didn't really know what that was about up until then. And the Talmud is the scripture that came after the Bible in the Jewish religion and is looked upon as scripture. It's a whole different way of thinking. It's a big paradigm shift from the biblical God. Most Jews and even Christians today think that they're worshiping the God of the Bible. But the Talmud has a different vision of God, and it's not personality-wise the God of the Torah and the rest of the Hebrew Bible. It's a completely different paradigm.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there because we're going to get into that as we discuss the book some okay. more. But I also was struck that at age 19, you reported that you went to India, and you went across the entire Indian subcontinent. Did you go to to study with a
an ashram?
To an ashram?
No, not formally as such.
Okay, but you did go and study Zen with a Zen master in Japan later, and so you have a long acquaintance with issues having to do with spirituality and with God. And I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that you had a life-threatening experience that you were lucky to escape from. And you say you wrote about that in one of your earlier books, but I don't recall it. Can you give us a quick resume of that?
Yeah. I was traveling around India. And what I did was arrange for my funds to be sent in installments to banks in India, because I didn't want to be traveling with too much cash on me.
Yeah, right, smart.
Credit cards weren't around yet. and if they were, even India was not equipped with them. This was before Mother Teresa was even known. And I had to go to Calcutta to replenish my funds. And in Calcutta, I was mugged, and they took everything, my money, my passport, my visa. And as I said, Mother Teresa wasn't around, and the city was going through a big crisis. There was a cholera outbreak. There were dead people littered all over on the streets.
Under oh, my goodness. Covers.
A truck went around in the morning and picked up the corpses. It was also monsoon season coming, and it was very hot and very humid. And on top of that, there was no Canadian consulate or embassy in Calcutta.
Wow.
I went to the American consulate, and they couldn't help me because I was not at the time a citizen. But they advised me to go to the British consulate because, as a Canadian, I'm a subject of the British Empire. This is 1973. I lived out on the streets of Calcutta for a couple of weeks, almost.
Oh my goodness.
A lot of different adventures with that, all of them dangerous, you know, to be on the streets of Calcutta as a foreigner. But at the end of it, I entered this state of ponderance on what it was all about and what did it mean and what is this awareness that was growing in me. And it was a sense of unity and surrender with and to the environment I was in.
Wow.
And that kept going one item at a time. Well, here goes my physical safety, and then goes my physical health. I contracted a terrible rash in that heat. Plus my cholera vaccine expired. And it was a very tough time. You know, the Communist Party of India were rioting in the streets and having peace demonstrations when they weren't rioting. And I fell into this state of empty oneness, as my Zen teacher later called it, which was a state of oneness with the environment and with the people and with what was happening to me, and a surrender to it.
Wow.
That allowed me to get in touch with the part of our consciousness that seems to be below or transcendent of the surface happenings in society,
yeah.
in the world.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of my interest in comparative religion.
Right.
You asked about if I went to India to study in an ashram. Well, not formally, but an Italian person I met before I arrived in Calcutta invited me to a community of yogis that cater to yogis who were retired themselves from the ashram and were just living life. And it was in the old ruins of the Vijayanagar Empire. It was a southern empire of India, I think in the 8th century AD, after current times. And these yogis lived like monks in the abandoned temples of the Vijayanagar Empire. And I ended up being with them. They didn't speak any English, and I didn't speak much more than a few phrases of the Hindi. But the Italian man was pretty well versed, and he was translating. And I ended up intrigued by the religious consciousness of these yogis. And that was the beginning of what inspired me, together with that experience in Calcutta, to go deeper.
Yeah. What a beginning. And I'm resonating to a lot of this in an interesting way, because something led me to want to read the book Kim, and it describes so vividly a lot of what was going on in India in the early days. And have you ever read Kim?
No, I haven't. I don't think I even know who he or she is.
Kim is a young boy whose father, actually, doesn't know hardly anything about his parents. And as far as he knows, he's Indian when he starts out, and he's kind of a ragamuffin, but he's very bright, and he becomes a spy for this powerful warlord. It's a fascinating story. And why am I blocking on the famous writer, well-known writer who wrote a lot of well-known?
Not Salman Rushdie.
No, this is way before that. Probably it'll pop into my mind, or I'll let you know after the call. I'll look it up, or you can look it up online. So let's get into discussing your book. And first of all, I want to compliment you on all the concrete examples in this book, because I think most people, and including me, have the impression that so much of Jungian writing is very abstract, some of it gets so abstract. And by contrast, your book is full of examples that ranging from Martha Stewart to Abraham Lincoln to Bob Dylan to Winston Churchill and Donald Trump and more. Was that a deliberate strategy as you approached this book, and what caused you to do that?
I think it was deliberate. I also gravitate toward illustration of ideas in everyday life to make it simpler and hit home where people live in their hearts. But I once I recognized how this complex works, I was able to see it almost everywhere, on a collective level in terms of history, and then on the level of individuals, all these people who you would never think had a deep psychological encounter, conscious or not, in terms of being able to resolve it. And I let the book unfold the way the material was coming at me. Beatles interview with the Beatles just out of pleasure. And I just realized in the moment, they were all under the Yabe complex when they were breaking up. So that's
I want to move on to that, but I just remembered there was another. You start off the book in the intro telling a story about your father and your relationship with your father. And I was surprised that you call him Leslie. It sounded like it was a very conservative, traditional home, and here you are calling your father Leslie. Was that common in that community, what?
No, we always called him Dad.
Oh, okay.
Like most families, but I didn't want to write it, referring to him as dad. The way my brother and I always speak, or often spoke about him with other people, we just use the word Leslie.
Okay, okay, that clears that up for me. So you were starting to talk about what you call the God complex in the book, and it's not that the book, despite what I said about the wonderful plethora of concrete examples from everyday life, and the book is not lacking theory. There is a lot of, it begins really with a lot of sort of historical and theoretical overview relating to God and, you know, whatever God is, whoever God is. And so you discuss it, you discuss God as Yahweh, and you talk about the God complex. So tell us about the God complex and what you mean by that. It's a big topic. Sure. I know.
Try to narrow it down a little. Most people think of the God complex as somebody thinking that they're God. But in fact, most people who have a God complex know very well that they're not literally God or the God of the Bible. They may not even know they have a God complex.
So it's not just people with an overweening ego and narcissism and so on who kind of act like, well, maybe it is actually.
They may demonstrate the attitudes, the emotional style, and the behaviors of the biblical God, because the God complex, it's not something you encounter in the East. When somebody says, I am God, or you are God, or we are all God in the East, this is well known to the people who grew up in the Hindu and Buddhist traditions. It is particularly in the West a complex, again, of the attitudes and the emotional style and the actions or behavior of the biblical God as described in the Hebrew Bible. But everybody in the Abrahamic traditions, which are Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. There are other Abrahamic traditions I don't talk about in the book. For example, the Samaritans, the Baha'i faith, they're all descended from the same patriarch of the Hebrew Bible, who was Abraham.
Okay.
And as the Bible unfolds, we see increasingly that God himself, the biblical God himself in the Bible, is changing. His personality is evolving. In that, both sides of life come to his service and enter the story of the Bible. And by both sides of the life, I mean here.
That was a fascinating thing that I'd never heard before, encountered before, was that the God of the Bible was developing and went through developmental stages. And that's really a brand new idea for me. And I think it'll be a brand new idea for many people out there and for our listeners and viewers. So how does the God of the Bible compare to, say, the Greek and the Roman gods? Because growing up in the Western tradition, we all have more or less some familiarity, or especially people who are interested in Jungian psychology will have had some brush with those gods. Is this God different than those gods?
Well, he's a different entity and a different personality. And he manifested in a different historical and cultural way than, for example, the gods of the Greek pantheon. The one big difference there is the fact that, indeed, the Greek gods form a pantheon of different gods who all have their own personalities and their own agendas. Poseidon was the god of the sea, and et cetera, et cetera. Zeus was one of the chief fathers of the other gods. And what happened with the slow rise of monotheism, the gods of the Near East, particularly in Canaan, where the Israelites settled after the Exodus, they amalgamated the many different gods of the Babylonian, and then and before them the Sumerian, and then after them the Greek. They take all the Greek gods, all the gods of the pantheon, and they put, or he evolved into one god. And that became a huge asset in certain ways and a huge problem in other ways. Because on the one hand, this god became a mega personality. He became like the Godhead, and like a fountain that everything comes out of. It was the beginning of a different kind of religious experience. The dark side of it was that Yahweh didn't have any siblings or parents. And consequently, before creation, he then would have been just himself. Now, we know from the oral tradition that he created the angels, such as Lucifer, who was originally the angel of light before he fell and became a dark god. But there were other gods, too. Mostly in the Hebrew Bible, it's not, as people often think, singularly monotheistic. It was, for much of its development, it was henotheistic, which means one chief god above all the others in the pantheon. But he eventually became just one god, and the focus in the Hebrew Bible is on the relationship the ancient Israelites had with this one god.
Yeah, and you refer to him in one place, this was another big idea for me, as the orphan god, yes. Because there's no accounting of where he came from. He just always was.
Yeah. Yeah, I borrowed that notion from Jack Miles, who illustrated that God did not have any relationships, never mind with humans, but with anything, because there was only God. So when humans come on the scene, Yahweh discovers that the creatures he created didn't turn out the way he had hoped. And he created them to be, among other things, less lonely. But the ancient people before Abraham, like Noah and Adam and Eve, of course, and Cain and Abel, they disappointed God. Instead of bringing him company and fellowship, they brought him, as they would say in Yiddish, a lot of sorus, you know, a lot of headaches, because they did not behave well. They ate of the tree they were forbidden to eat of, and that, of course, started the drama of the Bible. If that had not happened, we would all still be in the Garden of Eden, and after a while, what would we be talking about? Because nothing changed there.
Yeah.
But when Adam and Eve fell, actually, the Zohar, the Kabbalistic book, scripture, the Zohar, indicates in a very subtle way that God fell with Adam and Eve. So when Adam and Eve went into exile out of the Garden of Eden, Yahweh, or the biblical God, went with them. And there begins the drama of Judaism and Christianity.
Yeah. And this kind of the idea of God developing and his personality changing really helps me to understand something that I always struggled with was why was he so punitive? You know, why did he wipe people out for not believing in him or not worshiping him in the ways that he directed and so on? And that just seemed like, wow, that's like a 2-year-old kid who wants his way.
Well, he's been described that way. Even Freud pointed out that he was a volcano god, very volatile.
Uh-huh.
The question is very interesting because it brings to mind right away these shooters who go on shooting sprees. And we now have, at this time, almost 2 or 3 of those a week in the country.
Oh, the shooters. I misunderstood.
Shooters
who go on shooting sprees.
Okay. Right. And what little they can find out about the shooters, most of them commit suicide before they're caught, but not all of them. And their writings are left and their postings on the internet are left. And what comes out is that they feel terribly abandoned and betrayed by their peers, very lonely, very angry, and it's stewing in them, and very underneath the anger, very hurt.
Uh-huh.
Think of God in the Hebrew Bible. Well, the Hebrew Bible is the story of God's childhood, but with later scriptures, including the Talmud, which we talked about, and then the Quran in Islam and the New Testament in Christianity, God begins to develop out of his childhood and enter, as I see it, his adolescence. It was only much later with the mystics that he actually entered full adulthood. So you do see this evolution of God, and of course it parallels the evolution of human consciousness, since you don't get one without the other. Of course, in the non-duality traditions, which is a whole other topic, you do get that. But commonly in our society today, people still have a very old idea of God and with little awareness of who the biblical God became. He became a mystical God, but that's only there in little hints in the Hebrew Bible. We are, with the amount of people and the way it manifests with the Ave complex, that right away illustrates the personality of God in us. It's the God complex. It's modeled on the biblical God. And that is why people don't have to go around saying, I am God, or I think I'm God. They don't think they're God. They're just not aware that the behavior imitates the biblical God, because they're caught in a similar primitive emotional place.
Yeah. Yeah. And you talk about there is a duality that you discuss. You explore to some extent his feminine side. You say that there is a feminine side, and then later we see the his duality in darkness and light.
Yeah,
talk about those a little bit. I know that in Jungian thought, the feminine is a very important concept.
Yeah, well, it is in all three of the Abrahamic religions in different ways. According to the oral tradition, Yahweh created a female partner for himself before Adam and Eve. And that was Chochmah. Chochmah is both the ancient and medieval word for wisdom. And Chochmah was the goddess that Yahweh created as his spouse, his divine partner. And the two of them created creation together.
Uh-huh.
That becomes evident in the Hebrew Bible with the book of Proverbs. God is not much talked about in the book of Proverbs, which is one of the later books of the Hebrew Bible, inside the Hebrew Bible. And she's really very much modeled on Sophia, the Greek goddess of wisdom. And Jung argues that Yahweh, when he got caught up with the drama of what Adam and Eve did, biting of the apple of the knowledge of good and evil, which started the whole dynamic of good and evil, and therefore the drama of humans to evolve into better beings than they were in the beginning. Not that that has happened all that much necessarily. Sophia or Chochmah come later in the Hebrew Bible as they're getting ready to close the Hebrew Bible and move on to the Talmud. And of course, the New Testament came at the same time around as the Talmud. So, Chochmah then was embodied in Mary, the mother of Jesus, also the lover of Jesus, however one conceives that, and the other Mary. There's two Marys. They're both actually two feminine images on a single continuum. But you see the feminine coming back in. And then, of course, in Christianity, that was repressed for centuries and centuries. And only with the Pope John the 23rd, I think it was, who created, you know, he said, let's open up the windows of the Vatican and let some fresh air in. And when they did that, well, the feminine just came right up. And Jung was very complimentary about how important and colorful and meaningful that could be. So Jung lived long enough to see the feminine begin to return in the West. Uh-huh. I want to point out something, David. You know, this new book was originally a part of a much larger book that got divided into two. And the first part, which is The Divine Mind, you interviewed me on that book too. There I talk mostly about how God changed, how God evolved, and what happened to him. Because Yahweh wasn't as all-knowing and omniscient as modern people project. There was a lot he didn't understand and was confused by, just like we as readers of the Hebrew Bible are confused by the same things. In fact, Yahweh was very much, in the early Israelite tradition, perceived as a man. He described himself as a man of war, and he saw himself as the commander-in-chief of the Israelite 12 tribes that went in and conquered the promised land. There I talk about how what happened to God in that big story of the Hebrew Bible. This book is about what happened to us humans because of what happened to God. And what is it that happened to us? Well, we internalize Yahweh because we no longer saw him on the stage of history. And now he lives inside us, but as a psychological complex. And that's part two of that combined book. But Okay. Readers don't need to read one or the other first. They both flow into each other in a reciprocal kind of way. But the this book is more about the psychological complex of the biblical God. And the Divine Mind, the previous one, is more about the historical evolution of the biblical God.
Okay, well, let's...
Not just the biblical evolution, but right up to the modern times.
Yeah, speaking of that, let's bring in the modern examples of the complex that you cite. And one of the people that you talk about is Bill Gates, the young Bill Gates you describe as master of the universe.
Yeah.
Tell us about Bill Gates and how that archetype lives in him.
Yeah. Well, Bill Gates' story is the first chapter of the book. And I actually started writing that about 8 or 9 years ago, maybe 10. You know, I write more than one thing at the same time, so that's why it takes so long to publish. And he was my first choice because, as the opening epigraph to the chapter says, Bill Gates is an all-American boy. He's the story of the successful man, modeled very much on the industrial barons of the Industrial Revolution, like Melanie,
Carnegie and Mellon.
Carnegie and Rockefellers and all of those people.
Yeah.
Bill Gates is like a modern incarnation of that spirit.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, I basically wrote about his follies as a young boy, really. He was like something like 14 years old, and he was already designing what later became Microsoft and the computer. And then as I approached the rewrite of the book, which was probably at the shortly after the beginning of COVID, I realized, oh, Bill Gates followed the arc of Yahweh. What happened to Yahweh happened to Bill Gates too. Yahweh over time became more human, more civilized, more loving, more kind. He wasn't the one-sided warrior god or simply the god of law, the 613 Mosaic laws. He became a more embodied, rounded personality. And you see that with Bill Gates when he left his position as president of Microsoft and turned it over to the next baron who would continue to develop it. And he began to get into different philanthropic causes. He was a huge contributor of funds to find the COVID vaccine. He wrote a book not too long ago on climate change with very concrete suggestions. Not all the ecologists agree with what he wrote, but it says something about him and where our other industrial barons need to evolve to in terms of their concern for
what
the
planet. What is the role of his wife, Melinda Gates, in this shift of his behavior and consciousness, do you think?
Well, I suppose you could say that just like Yahweh with Chokhmah, he discovered his heart and developed his heart with his encounter with his wife. The feminine has a way of softening up the hardness and the hardening of categories of the biblical God. So you see that Bill Gates, like other people in the book, really evolved, and they evolved from a lower level of Yahweh's personality in them being acted out to a more higher level. And you see the pendulum swings from the dark side to something a little more integrating the dark with the light. So the last part of the book, there's four parts, and part four is about the positive Yahweh complex, which by critics, even theologians, is often played up. Often one side or another is played up, but not the two together. And in truth, we're people who, we evolve by the yin-yang principle, that the complementary opposite is what brings a sense of wholeness.
Yeah.
And that happened to Bill Gates, and that's why I put him in the front of the book.
The thing that I love about the yin-yang symbol is that it's dynamic, because the seed of the opposite, you know, you'll see in the black part, there'll be a little dot of white, and in the white, there's a little dot of black. And so it suggests a dynamic of change and evolution, and not it's not going to settle down in one place.
Yeah.
So I think that people who think that we're going to, on this earth, find some kind of ultimate peace and positivity, heaven on earth, it's not according to the nature of how nature seems to work. It's going to be constantly evolving. I'm going to skip around in some of the people that you mentioned in various chapters. You talk about the Rolling Stones and you talk about the Beatles. How can we work them in?
Well, if you look at the different editions of the final recordings and period of the Beatles, you see that the last two albums, they knew they were beginning to head in their own directions, and that it was the climax of the 10 years that they were together, and they were bickering a lot. Peter Jackson did this documentary, which Get Back, I think is the title of it, where he showed that the later recording period, there was harmony and joy between them, and they loved each other and they loved the music. But it doesn't take away from some of the darker scenes. in that period where they were arguing with each other and they could barely tolerate each other. Ringo went off to Sardinia for a vacation when he got fed up, and then George Harrison quit 1 week and didn't come back till the next week, and the other Beatles didn't know if it was over then. The band was broken up over then. The way the Ave Complex seems to have manifested with the Beatles was through the mechanism of what is known in psychoanalysis as projective identification. Jung talked about that, borrowing a concept of the anthropologist Levi Brühl. He talked about that as, why am I blanking on it? It's a merging of boundaries. And you see this a lot in families that are dysfunctional. They're not on their side of the turf. They're making a lot of you statements and making the other party defensive, so that they're very hard to get resolution to the problems. There's a sense of bitterness and defeat. And Paul McCartney, who had the whole period of that ending being filmed in a film that he conceived would be the next Beatles film, and he was interviewed about that and much later after the Beatles broke up, and he said that what you see in those tapes about our later sessions was the beginning of the breakup of a band. And yeah, that's exactly what it was. Projective identification happens when people identify with a mood or a feeling like a depression or anger or hurt, and they think it's their own feeling, their own mood, because it's happening in them.
Yeah.
Well, that's the Ave complex. It's happening in us, but it gets projected out because we're not looking for Yahweh in ourselves. And the Beatles weren't looking into themselves in an interrelated way at that point. So they all thought that they were the only one in the band who was suffering. And they, the other three were united. And there's that, and I present the whole discussion that Ringo gave, that they all, I think it was Paul or Ringo, they went from door to door of each other's home. And every time they said, look, I'm going to take a leave of absence. You three guys seem to be really together and I'm just not playing well. And they all said that. And then they realized that they had fallen into something that they all felt. Well, that was the Ave complex. The Ave complex is very much about dissociation and breakdown, unfolding the way the Hebrew Bible does with the personality of Yahweh into a rejuvenation and a kind of redemption, which transforms the bitter period into one of insight or light.
What about the Rolling Stones? How does the complex show up there?
Well, initially it was not so dissimilar from the Beatles. They were bickering with each other. Keith Richards, in his very interesting autobiography, This Life is the title of it, or Life. He says there was a period where the Rolling Stones, the other ones beside Mick Jagger, were making fun of Mick by calling him Brenda because he was behaving like a woman who had to be the center of attention. Richard said, as part of the syndrome of lead singers, that they think that they're the essence and the entirety of the band and the others are just musicians. So they had that too, but that was not the way it went with them. They worked that stuff through to a large extent and managed to stay together. I mean, you know, the Beatles were together 10 years. The Stones, it's been, I think it's going on to 60 years already, if not almost. They've really been around and they've survived. Yeah. The way the Ave complex erupted with the Rolling Stones was in their identification with the passions of the soul and with whether they stated as such or not, the Dionysian god, Dionysus, who was the god of ecstasy and joy and sensuality and sexuality and erotic love. A lot of their music is about that. Even in their elderly years, they're still, you know, with younger women and writing about this, the romance of life that the feminine can introduce into a man's psyche. And it's with the idea of what all the British rock bands did. They picked up on the genre of soul and blues of the American rock and early rock and roll, and jazz as well. And they made it their own. And it's usually, you know, a lot of lyrics about the workings of passion.
Okay.
So they don't really have a Yahweh complex. What they have is a Dionysus complex. And what you is interesting, and I try to present that in the chapter on them, that you see in the lyrics and in the music, especially the late Rolling Stones, which nobody listens to. Mick Jagger complains that when they go on tour, everybody wants to hear the old songs.
Right, but right.
That they really evolved musically. They're very sophisticated musicians, and very few people listen to their later stuff, to their own consternation.
Yeah.
But what you really see in the lyrics is this implicit battle between Dionysus and Yahweh, and a battle for the soul. Who gets to live in the human soul now in the West? And in a sense, you see the same thing in the chapter on Marilyn Monroe and her marriage to Joe DiMaggio. They're two gods at war, and it's the same two gods. It's Dionysus, whom, of course, Marilyn Monroe embodied and projected and pulled out of the culture. And Joe DiMaggio, who was quite a Yahvist, didn't know a thing about Yahweh or the Hebrew Bible. But as the book tries to show, you don't need to have read the Hebrew Bible or know about it to enact the complex of its central god. You know, all those examples are illustrating the different angles and ways the Yahweh complex can manifest.
Right. So how about Bob Dylan? You talk about his
apocalyptic sensibility.
Yeah, I was having trouble pronouncing it. Apocalyptic, sensibility, yeah.
Well, he has been a devout. He has been a devout Jew, and during his Christian period, a devout Christian as well. He has been a devout believer in the God of the biblical traditions since he was a very young man, and even at the very early beginnings of his folk songs, you find beautiful lyrics devoted to the wonders of the divine in the soul and in nature and in romance particularly. What you really find as the apocalyptic, as the Yahvistic edge is his delving into apocalypticism, particularly Christian apocalypticism. I point out some differences between that and the Jewish tradition he comes from. He's pretty much, I understand, following a Jewish path. But when it comes to the apocalypse, he's more on the Christian side. The Christian and Jewish and Muslim sides all have slightly different takes on what the apocalypse will be and why we need it. Not just that we create it out of our ignorance with nuclear weapons and so forth, but we need it for our transformation. And the Jewish version has a more peaceful view on that, whereas the Christian one, based on the book of Revelation, the last book of the New Testament, the apocalypse is presented in starker and darker terms.
Yeah.
But through all of that, you can look for the apocalypse motif in Dylan's work from his days as a young man to today as well. He writes a lot about it. And even when he doesn't refer to it directly, it's there between the lines. If you know how to read his poetry, he's very concerned about what will happen to us. And he's very skeptical that it will happen without a dark apocalypse.
Speaking of the dark apocalypse, we can't leave this without talking about Donald Trump, and you devote a fair amount in the book to your discussion of Donald Trump. So take us there, or take us away from there, either way.
Well, he's a good example of that you don't have to think you are literally God to have the Ave complex. You just don't know that you have it. He kind of, I think, knows his effect on people, and he knows how to manipulate that. When he said, I could murder somebody on Fifth Avenue and people would still vote for me, that says something both about his psychology and the psychology of his followers. He ran the government, and his behaviors, both in word, where he could be very destructive, and action, behavioral modeling that his followers, his key supporters, latched onto about him. His actions and his behaviors are very Old Testamentish, if I could use a term like that. Yahweh wasn't very aware, as Jung points out in answer to Job, of the effects he had on people. So Yahweh could wipe out Job's entire family and give Job every disease that the human body can manifest, and be doing it as part of a wager with Satan as to how long will Job last in his faithfulness to Yahweh if Yahweh treats him in this way. Well, Yahweh was, you know, contrary to what Einstein said, that God doesn't play dice with the universe. Well, with Job, he certainly was playing dice. He was wagering with Satan how much abuse he would take when he would forsake his faith to Yahweh. He had no awareness of the suffering it would cause. And even when he restored Job's family to Job, he didn't restore them to the old family. He didn't resurrect his previous family. He created new family, as if that replaces the old one in some strange kind of logic that Yahweh has. Right up to the end, the Hebrew Bible ends on a very positive note, and I'm talking about the Hebrew Bible, not the Christian Old Testament. They're two slightly different books in terms of their arrangement. Right up till the very end, Yahweh is not very self-conscious. He doesn't have a conscience. He has that narcissistic quality of not having empathy for another's suffering. And you see that very much in Trump.
Yeah.
He had absolutely no compassion for all the people who died in COVID and their surviving families. When he made fun of that Pakistani-American couple whose son was, I think, given a Medal of Honor serving in the armed forces, he made fun of those parents. His actions with the issue of immigration and the border between Mexico and the U.S. and all those children in detainment facilities separated from their parents at an age of before five. He could have stopped that right away. It didn't cross his mind. So, I mean, you can go on forever. You know, we're going to be hearing a lot of things from historians in the next 10 years. And the drama is not over, as I mentioned in the release, new updated version of my book on American culture, America's Identity Crisis. Even before, even in the very first year of Trump's presidency, I had the feeling that his impact would last much longer than 4 years, and that the president of this period, nobody knew it would be Biden for sure. Nobody knew for sure. But, you know, as many people projected ahead, they said it's going to take a long time to fix all the things that Donald Trump took down. And the aspect of Yahvé that he, perhaps more than other aspects, demonstrated was the scorched earth policy of Yahvé. Yahvé, when he went to war, commanded the Israelites for many of the townships of the Canaanites that the Israelites conquered. Yahvé instructed the Israelites to level the ground of those settlements. Unless they voluntarily surrender, raise the ground down, and kill every man, woman, child, and even their animals. That kind of policy of dismantling the government, one department at a time, and one, you know, it took a long time for the environmental guardianship agency to develop. That department was set up by Nixon, a conservative, and Trump just totally dismantled it. You don't hear about them anymore at all. So I didn't want to justify his presidency by sucks the air out of the room so that he gets more airtime than the current president does. I didn't want to repeat that in the book, and therefore I didn't want to give him a chapter of his own.
But yeah,
one could write an entire two or three volumes on everything he did and compare it to Yahvé's point of view on things, and it's like you're reading the Hebrew Bible almost.
Okay, well, let's close with you giving a little pitch for the book. Who should read this book and why?
Well, at the risk of sounding grandiose myself, I hope I'm not. It's for everyone. Those chapters are from popular culture. I only have one patient story in them. I have a number of U.S. presidents and Putin's in there, and everything going on around us and amidst us is talked about. The Yahvé complex is perhaps the most all-encompassing and dark complex of all the complexes we have. He's a war god. And we are still in the throes of collective childhood, Jung said. We haven't evolved very much at all in the last 10 millennia. We see this very clearly with the kinds of war and the different numbers of wars going on at any given time that don't get covered by the media. We're warlike creatures. And some people denigrate human beings by saying we're animals. Well, we behave worse than many of the animals do. We don't only destroy for our survival to eat meat, but because, sad to say, we love it. There seems to be something in human nature that won't go away. And as James Hillman said, our wars will continue as long as our war gods are central in driving us forward.
Well, we live in a very confusing moment, I think. And yeah. And so I recommend my listeners seek out your book because it will help them understand the confusing period that we're going through. And Michael Gellert, I want to thank you for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Once again, it was my privilege to have Jungian analyst Michael Gellert, LCSW, back on the show. This time, our conversation focused on his most recent book, Legacy of Darkness and Light, Our Cultural Icons and Their God Complex. Reviewing his background a bit brings out how supremely qualified he is to write a book about God and spirituality. We discover he grew up in Montreal, the son of conservative Jewish parents who had moved there to escape the Holocaust. We also find out he traveled to India at age 19 and was mugged in Calcutta, losing all his money and passport in the process. He couldn't get a change of clothes and was forced to live on the streets during a cholera epidemic in which dead bodies were lying all about the streets. This all happened before there were cell phones or an internet had been invented. So he was really up against it without any way to reach out to parents or family or friends. Not surprisingly, this assault on his senses and reality as he had known it created an altered state of consciousness in which he experienced a kind of state of Satori he eventually realized later. He eventually traveled with a multilingual Italian who took him to a community of older yogis and he lived there for 2 years. He also spent 2 years in Japan studying under a Zen master there. It's easy to understand how these formative experiences created a unique spiritual orientation and an ability to look at different religions from an objective perspective. And of course, his training as a Jungian analyst further cemented this analytic and historical stance toward conceptions of the gods. Toward the end of the interview, I asked him who should read this book, and he replied, everyone. After some reflection, I agree. We find ourselves living in a particularly fraught and confusing time. Michael's book, with its documenting of the dark side of God's nature and the ways we have internalized it into a God complex, using contemporary examples ranging from Martha Stewart to Abraham Lincoln to Bob Dylan to Winston Churchill to Donald Trump and more, provides us with some perspective. I think he's given us a kind of roadmap to navigate, to calm our anxieties and realize we are living through a particular historical transition. It's a cyclical process. We can't know how it will end, but wars and rumors of war is nothing new. The book is Legacy of Darkness and Light, Our Cultural Icons and Their God Complex by Jungian analyst Michael Gellert.
Hi, Dr. Dave. My name is Paul Fishman. I practice psychiatry in San Francisco, and I've been a listener to Shrink Wrap Radio podcasts on my phone for over a year. I'm finally getting around to sending you a donation. I've hesitated to go to your website to find the donation link because I wanted to do so along with sending you kudos in the form of a particular reflection on one of your podcasts, hoping I'd thereby encourage others to donate. I might have done so on several inspiring occasions over the past year, but I haven't had the time. I want to encourage other listeners not to do as I have done. Go to the website now and click the donate link. Your reflections are not required to make a donation.
Thank you, San Francisco psychiatrist Paul Fishman. Thanks for donating and encouraging others to follow your fine example. I agree, no commentary on a favorite interview is necessary. Just make that donation and help us keep the lights on. Once again, time to shrink wrap it up. Thanks to Jungian analyst Michael Gellert for speaking about his latest book on the God Complex and the Legacy of Darkness and Light. I particularly appreciate the way he brings the God complex to life with many examples from film, current news, and popular media. I'm going to skip a week so you can find a good past show you might have missed by scrolling through the All Shows link on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. Until next time... which will be in 2 weeks. This is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourself, others, and our precious Earth.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.